Did you notice that in the text that we read this morning, that there's a little bit of a contrast in them? Can you put the text back up? Is that okay? So we can see that. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. Both of these are in Matthew. Both of them are spoken by Jesus. The ethical teachings of Jesus, particularly in the Sermon on the Mount, are beautiful. They're very simple. But when you begin to think about them, they get a little harder to understand. The idea of a peacemaker seems very clear. But then Jesus says about himself, I did not come to bring peace but a sword. How can that be? One thing we can all agree on, I think, is that the world needs more peacemakers. North Korea, Syria, Egypt, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. I really don't need to go on, do I? That's a pretty easy idea to agree on. We need peacemakers in our workplaces, peacemakers in our schools. We need peacemakers in our homes. We need peacemakers in our church. Actually, the church should be the model of how to deal with differences, shouldn't it? It should be the center of peacekeepers, and it should demonstrate to the world how Christians resolve differences. It should be, but it's about 25 years ago, but I still remember it quite well. It was my introduction to a new job and to church conflict. I had just left San Diego, where I'd lived and worked for almost 20 years, and had kind of fallen in love with the place, particularly with the ocean climate. And I'd moved to Riverside because I'd been asked to be the superintendent of schools for the conference. I was excited about the challenge, looking forward to it, a little nervous because I was pretty new to that. I was in my first week in the office. It was in the summertime, so the schools were out, so there wasn't a whole lot that was pressing. The conference president came into my office and sat down. I thought, well, that's nice. Says, Chuck, I want you to work on, and then he named this school. And I'm not going to use the name because a number of the people who were involved in this story are still alive. So we'll just call it Central School. It says, Chuck, I want you to work on Central School. Okay. He said, things are really bad there. Okay. They're really fighting a lot. Yeah. And no one can seem to get it fixed. Okay. So I want you to work on it. Yes, sir, I'll work on it. He left. Never heard anything about Central School. I mean, I knew there was a school there. I'd never seen it. I knew where the town was. It was ways away from my office. So I asked my associates in the office, what's going on at Central School? the president wants me to work on the problem. Well, when they began to roll their eyes, I knew this was not good. So they told me a bit of the history about how totally dysfunctional the school board was. And they told me that almost every associate in the Office of Education had taken a turn at trying to get it solved. And it wouldn't solve, including the former superintendent who I replaced. Well, the board meeting came up. I hopped in my car and I drove to Central School. It was a small school. Four teachers, one of whom was the teaching principal. How hard could this be? I drove in the parking lot and I saw the school for the first time. It was pretty impressive. It was fairly new. Nice construction. Parking lot was nice. The playground area was nice. So I got out of my car and went in. One of my very first board meetings, new on my job. And I met the principal there, a teaching principal, young man, about 30 years old. We'll just call him Rick for the purposes of this story. And some board members began to filter in. Got to know their names, and we sat down as it got closer to the time for the meeting to begin, 7 o'clock. At 7 straight up, the door opened, and in came person after person. And there weren't any smiles on their faces. And they sat in a straight line at the table across from the rest of us. They could have sat anywhere, on the sides, on our side. There were plenty of seats. They sat all together, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Well, I may have been new on the job, but I knew that was not a good sign. They obviously had met before the meeting. That's why they all came together. And they were undoubtedly talking about the meeting and what they wanted to accomplish. There are two churches that ran this school, the school board. There was the big church that had the 7 members like a phalanx on one side, and there was the little church, which had much fewer members, and that's the side that the principal sat on. We had prayer. And of course, in a meeting, the very first thing you do after prayer is you approve the minutes. It normally takes around 30 seconds to vote minutes. People rarely even read them. Okay? But that didn't happen that night. They wanted to talk about the minutes at length. They did not like the minutes. They did not like how they were written. They did not think they were accurate. They talked about the minutes for 30 minutes. And they finally voted to not approve the minutes. They didn't amend the minutes. They voted not to approve them. I was thinking to myself, exactly what does that mean? Does that mean the meeting never happened? Well, it turns out that the principal of the school, he was a full-time teacher, and he's also the administrator, a job that no one should ever have to do, but people do it every day. So it's basically two jobs in one, and they pretty much expected him to act like a full-time administrator. He had to take the minutes at the board meeting, and he had to write them up, or his secretary. They didn't like him. And they did not like his minutes. And so that vote was directly a vote against him. They actually had a board action that had taken some time earlier, that any time anyone made a motion, they had to stop, turn on a tape recorder. The person making the motion would then identify themselves and state the motion on the tape recorder, and the person who seconded it would have to give their name on the tape recorder, and then the principal was supposed to take that and type the minutes out with the motions verbatim, and he better get it right. Yeah, well, I figured, okay, I can see why this is a problem here. What am I going to do? So I got to know the key people on the board. I actually made a point to take them out to lunch one at a time. The board chairman, the pastor of the big church. I wanted to interact with them. I wanted them to become a little more familiar with me and comfortable with me. And I didn't sit there and talk for the whole meal about the problems at the school. I actually just tried to make it a pleasant occasion. Things did not improve from week to week. We weren't making much progress. We had a meeting in December. It was about one day before Christmas vacation started. The meeting started at 7 and it finished at midnight. I had a long ways to drive to get home that night because I still lived in San Diego at that point, and I was going to drive to San Diego after the meeting. But they beat up on that principal pretty good that night, and I knew that he was really mad. So I hung around after the meeting until everyone else had gone. I got him alone. I said, "Rick," and I really couldn't get the conversation going because he took over. He says, "I've had it. I quit. I'm teaching tomorrow. I'm packing up my stuff. I'm gone." Oh, that's not good. So, you know, I sympathize with him. It was a tough meeting. I said, "Rick, this is a bad meeting. But don't make any instant decisions." I said, "Just let your emotions calm down. Then remember something. You're mad at the board. But if you quit in the middle of the year, it's the kids that are going to get hurt. And you're not mad at the kids. The kids love you, and the parents love you. So don't do something that hurts the kids. And it's not real good for you either." Well, over Christmas vacation, he had a chance to cool down. And he came back, and there were no big miracles that year on that school board, unless you call the fact that I managed to keep them from firing him until he got another job for the next year. So he managed to finish the year with no interruptions to the students, go on out of state to another job and another career, and they got to hire a new principal. That was my introduction to church-based conflict. Church-based conflict because it really was a church fight, but the school was right in the middle of it, and Rick, a likable young principal, he had a temper, and they pushed his button every board meeting, and you push him so far, and he would fight back, and he was pretty good at it. B- Blessed are the peacemakers. I had a chance that year to try to figure out what exactly I was supposed to do as a peacemaker. When I say, or when you read the word peacemaker, you probably think the way I do. A peacemaker, what would that be? That'd be a pacifist, someone refuses to bear arms, or someone who's very meek, never has a contrary opinion, or someone who avoids conflict. You know, one way to keep peace is you just leave the room. Someone just who won't ever fight. Is that what Christ wants us to do? Peacemakers. What exactly does Christ want us to do as peacemakers? I'm going to tell you some stories, and you judge who the peacemakers were. It's 1938. Europe was barely recovering. There was still a depression on, but barely recovering from World War I. Nobody wanted to see that happen again. Woodrow Wilson had said this was the war to end all wars. Sounded like a good idea at the time, but it just didn't work. Hitler had come to power in Germany. And by this point, he had started to add territory. Austria first, and now he wanted the German-speaking portions of Czechoslovakia, called Sudetenland. And he moved his forces in. The rest of Europe was scared. They did not want war. So they went to Munich. Great Britain, France, Italy, to meet with Hitler, to see if they could calm this guy down. The Prime Minister of England took the lead in this, Neville Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain really wanted to avoid war. They signed an agreement called the Munich Pact, which gave the Sudetenland to Hitler. It legitimized what he had done in exchange for his promise to say he wouldn't do that anymore. Chamberlain was proud of what he had done. When he got off the plane in Britain, in London, he held up the pact that was signed, and he said, "We have peace in our time." They didn't. The only thing that that pact accomplished, it told Hitler that he could push the other democracies around. They were afraid of him. In 1939, he invaded Poland. Great Britain declared war on him. Neville Chamberlain was still in power. He got to be the prime minister that was in place at the beginning of the war. He was trying to be a peacemaker. He was trying to avoid war. He didn't make it. Abraham Lincoln was elected as president in November of 1861. Instantly, South Carolina seceded from the Union, followed in short order by six other southern states. In those days, the inauguration didn't happen until March. So there was a several-month gap, long enough time so that lots of bad things could happen because things were really tense. Before he took office, the Confederacy was already formed. Not all of the states had joined yet, but there were six states in the Confederacy, seven states at that point. There was a Union or a federal fort in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, in the water. The navies, the ships of the southern states, put a blockade around it. The commander notified his superiors that he was running out of supplies, including food. Lincoln became president in the middle of that crisis. He notified him that he had enough food to last until the 15th of April. Lincoln ordered Union ships to run the blockade and gave them the authority to fire if necessary. They attempted to run the blockade, they didn't make it. The South then opened fire on Fort Sumter, and it ran for 32 hours before the commander surrendered. He had no choice. Was Lincoln a peacekeeper? The result of that event, and many other causes as well, was the Civil War, the most violent war in American history. Was Lincoln a peacekeeper? He did the opposite of Chamberlain. He got a war too. In 1965, the civil rights movement seemed to be making progress. They were very happy that in 64, Congress had passed the Civil Rights Act, a landmark legislation. Martin Luther King Jr., who was the most visible leader, he wasn't all that happy about things. He had espoused the belief in nonviolence. He'd learned it from Christ, from the Sermon on the Mount. He'd seen it practiced by Gandhi. King had a very good education. He was a clergyman and a PhD. He'd read a lot of classical literature. He determined that that was the only way that they could be successful in achieving full equality, is through nonviolence. And he made that the cornerstone of what he did. But he was getting a fair amount of pushback in the civil rights movement from younger leaders, including the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who weren't all that happy with the idea of nonviolence, despite the fact that it was in their name. John Lewis was one of the leaders of that. And there was this guy in America in that day, in that time, by the name Malcolm X. And Malcolm X was pretty much pouring fuel on the fire. King knew that blacks had to vote, because whites controlled the power of the state government and the local governments, and blacks would never make appreciable progress, even with the Civil Rights Act, if all the state courts, if all the police and sheriffs, if all the local governments were run by segregationists. And why wouldn't they be? Blacks didn't vote. They didn't vote because they couldn't get registered. The law said they could vote, but they couldn't get registered because the registration committees were in the hands of the white office holders. And so when they would go to register, the window would be closed. Or more obviously, they would be given a literacy test. Well, many blacks couldn't read or not read well, but there were blacks that were educated and that could read. They didn't pass the test. One jurisdiction gave a government test, and one of the questions was, recite from memory the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. Well, I'm pretty familiar with the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, but I can't recite them from memory. I'm going to be bold enough to even suggest that Judge Macomber probably could not recite them from memory. So nobody passed the test. In Lowndes County, which was one of the worst counties, there were 5,000 black citizens. There were zero registered to vote. So blacks, with King's encouragement, began to push towards voting rights. They pushed in Selma, Alabama. That was in Dallas County. The sheriff was Jim Clark, and he was probably one of the best friends the civil rights movement ever had, only he would hate to be told that. He was the caricature of a white sheriff oppressing the blacks. Wore a helmet, a short jacket, always had his billy club, which he used. They just weren't getting anywhere in Selma. They got verbal agreement, but they couldn't get people registered no matter what they tried to do. So they decided that they would march from Selma to the capital, Montgomery, about a 5-day march. They would lay their petition on the Capitol steps for the governor, George Wallace. There was some intervening events that confused the situation, including a ruling by a federal district court judge, which was their only hope legally, because the state courts were not helpful to them. But this federal district judge was helpful, and they were going to have the march, and then they weren't going to have the march. King had left town. He was back in Atlanta. The morning of the march, they'd called for the march, and people came out, and he left his assistant, or another person in charge of the march. Right up to that moment, they didn't know whether they were going to march or not. But the assistant said, and they actually called King and got him out of church so he could talk to them. The assistant said, everybody's here. They're ready. We have 600 people. We need to march. So the march began. The first thing you have to do is cross the river. There was lots of different people in this march. A lot of students, college students, some even below college. Others as well. In order to cross the Alabama River, you have to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is no big deal, except for the fact that that's possibly the most dangerous time of the march. The marchers did not, most of them probably did not really think they would ever get to Montgomery. They thought they'd be arrested. They carried a little food with them because they thought it'd be hard to get food on the way. They maybe carried some extra clothes, and a lot of them carried a toothbrush. The reason was it was symbolic of the fact that you planned to go to jail. So you just took your toothbrush, you could brush your teeth in jail because you wouldn't be getting one. They crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and there in front of them was that, a crowd of blue-coated state troopers, Major Cloud's army, and Jim Clark with his sheriff's deputies, And Jim Clark had a posse made of citizens that swelled the ranks. These citizens had whips, cattle prods, and axe handles, and they intended on using them. The leaders were at the head of the march. Before they even got close to them, Major Cloud got on a bullhorn and said, this is an illegal assembly. You're in violation of the safety of the state of Alabama. This march is illegal. You have 2 minutes to turn around, go back to your church, and disperse. John Lewis, who was at the front of that march, called out and said, "Could we talk to you?" And Cloud just repeated the message. John Lewis and the others that were with him at the front said, "Everyone, let's pray. Kneel and pray." So John Lewis, that's actually a prayer that occurred before the march, but they're praying, so it fits my story well. John Lewis and the others knelt down to pray, and the troops attacked while they were praying. It was bad. It did not go well that day. The marchers were believers in nonviolence. The troopers thought they had an obligation to clear them out. Let's tear gas. They beat them on the ground. There were many that were seriously injured that day. There was a makeshift triage hospital nearby where they were taken. Fortunately for the civil rights movement, there were cameras there. And there were television cameras that were recording the incident. They played footage that night on the major networks. ABC played a whole length of footage without any commentary. This is one of the best things that happened to the civil rights movement. This is called Bloody Sunday, because it awakened more than ever before the conscience of the nation. The reaction nationwide was dramatic and strong. This was March 7, 1965. Before the year ended, Congress had passed and Johnson had signed the Voter Rights Act, which took over control and forced the states to register blacks. That act, more than the Civil Rights Act, changed the South permanently. When voters began to register, Jim Clark couldn't get reelected anymore. And all local officials had to keep an eye on their rhetoric and how they were treating blacks, because they might just be kicked out of office. Things began to change. I've told you three stories. Neville Chamberlain, Abraham Lincoln, Bloody Sunday. Who are the peacekeepers? Who are the peacemakers? We usually call officers peace officers. That's their job, is to keep the peace. In this case, they were the ones who caused the disturbance. When Jesus asks us to be peacemakers, what is he asking us to do? One way to try to understand it better is to look at his life. When he was arrested, tried, and beaten, he submitted to it, even to crucifixion. As Isaiah says, as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. If that's not all the Bible says about how Jesus acted, I'm going to read you a real short story from Mark. I want you to listen to the details of this story. Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched out his hand, and it was restored. Jesus deliberately did that on Sabbath in the synagogue. He even called the man to the front so no one could miss it. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Was Jesus being a peacemaker? Apparently, when you're a peacemaker, there are times when you have to act decisively. This is the same person who told us to turn the other cheek. But it's not as simple as one-liners, is it? When he was on the cross, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." When he was walking along, he healed a blind man. He told him he made mud from the dirt with his spit, put it on his eyes, said, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam." He did. He got discovered by the Pharisees and the priests, the scribes, and they became incensed because it was Sabbath. And they said, "This man can't be from God because he violates the Sabbath." Do you think Jesus forgot that it was Sabbath when he put the mud in his eyes? Of course not. He knew the reaction he would get. That's in John 9, if you want some afternoon reading. That whole chapter is that story. Very interesting story. You know, it's complex being a peacemaker. Sometimes you walk out of the room. Sometimes you answer anger with kindness. Sometimes you say, "It's enough." The problem is, when Jesus does it, he knows what he's doing. And his own emotions don't get in front of his actions. When I do it, I don't know, I can't read anyone else's heart. And my emotions get in front of my actions. And so when I am going to act very strongly in a situation, I'm much less confident that I'm being a peacemaker. But he calls us to do that. And if we are wanting to be the children of God, we have to take it seriously. It was August, many years ago, in Indiana, Sunday, 9:30 in the evening. Still warm, a nice warm summer evening, and the Schwartz family were headed home. Levi and Rebecca, mom and dad, they had seven kids. The oldest, Margaret, and the youngest, Adeline, and they were all in their carriage or their buggy because they were Amish, and this is Amish country. They drove on this country road. That's not actually the Schwartz's, but it's an Amish buggy. They drove on this country road on the way home, and they stayed to the side, of course, so cars could pass them. The people that lived in the area were used to this. I know that some of the Amish buggies have a bright red reflector on the back, so even at night you can see it and not accidentally hit it. And there wasn't a problem usually. But this particular night, actually it wasn't a sunny night, it was a Friday night. This particular night, a pickup truck was passing them, but then stopped. It's an older kind of a beat-up pickup truck. Then it slowed down and just went the same speed. And the windows were open on the truck, and they were yelling something. And they could tell, they couldn't tell for sure, but they could tell they were teenage boys. Not a good sign. Friday night, teenage boys, not a good combination. Well, they just basically ignored them. Mom was holding Adeline. She felt something sting her arm. It was dark in the carriage. She didn't think too much about it. And, you know, the sting went away in a minute or two. The pickup truck drove on, left them alone. And they continued on to their farm. And when they got to the farm, and they got out, all seven of them. Yeah, that's about seven. Except there's probably some boys in this group. They got out of the farm, and Mom handed Adeline to Margaret and said, take her in and put her in her crib while I help Dad put the horses away. So Margaret took Adeline in and got into the house, and when she turned on the kerosene lantern, she noticed that Adeline didn't seem right. So she put her in the crib but went right out to the barn to get Mom. Mom came in and examined Adeline, and then there was blood on her forehead. One of those boys in that pickup threw a clay tile, and through some twist of fate, it hit Adeline in the head and killed her. This story got picked up in all the news sources, went nationwide. Today we call it viral. Back then, they didn't have the internet. But it still went viral. There was a huge outcry against these boys. What a terrible thing they had done. By the way, the sheriff didn't have much trouble finding them. He'd already had reports about these guys in his pickup were out causing trouble that night. And they found them, and they arrested them. The whole country wanted the severest punishment possible. The problem was that these guys didn't have a criminal record. They hadn't broken the law or ever been arrested, at least. And when they checked with the school, they were just ordinary kids. They weren't the troublemakers. You know, it turns out that their crime was there were four teenage boys in a truck on Friday night acting like jerks. They probably never even intended that the brick hurt someone. They thought it would just clank on the vehicle and scare them. Who knows, but maybe a little alcohol was at work that night. Well, they pled guilty. There wasn't anything else to do. The judge did something very unusual. A lot of people did not like what the judge did. He sentenced them to 5 years in prison, but he then suspended it and imposed a $5,000 fine. That's mighty lenient for a killing. But the judge was helped in reaching his decision by a letter that he had been given that was written by the bishop of the Amish community, and it spoke for the community and the family. Here is what they wrote. "We believe that the four boys have suffered and suffered heavily since the crime. They have more than paid for what they did. Sending the defendants to prison would serve no good purpose, and we plead for leniency for them." Can you imagine? Blessed are the peacemakers. Shall we pray? Father in heaven, Jesus asked us to be peacemakers. Give us the willingness to do it. Give us the wisdom to know how to do it so that we can be called the children of God. Amen.